Just welcome everyone to our Sabbath service today. Beautiful November day. We can hardly believe it's November. And almost to Thanksgiving. That sounds good. But it's going fast. It's going so fast. Today I was wanting to talk a little about, do we always know, we know what we believe. If you ask most people, what do you believe about this or that, about their spiritual beliefs or whatever, they'll tell you what they believe. And they know, you know, we know what we believe. But do we know why we believe what we believe? A little double question there, I guess. But, you know, in 1 Peter 3:15, it says, be prepared to give an answer or reason for the hope that we have. And, you know, when we look at our little group, we find ourselves in a really small, tiny minority, you know, in Christianity. Here we keep the Sabbath, just a tiny, tiny little minority. Not many people do that. The vast majority keep Sunday. And if you would have somebody look at that, you know, just somebody, maybe a non-committed bystander, they would say, well, what's wrong with you? Why do you insist on walking uphill or swimming upstream? Why don't you get in line and you know, all these people can't be wrong. And, you know, you would maybe say, well, yeah, sounds that way. And so we need to really know why we believe what we believe. I think most people, you know, I'm convinced that people who keep the Sunday are sincere, very sincere about what they do. My mother always did. My family, the greatest majority, always kept and still do keep some. So, and we've done this before, but we need to be sure why we believe what we believe. And some of these things I won't read because for the sake of time, but, you know, in Genesis 2 and 2, it gives the account of creation. God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days and everything in them. On the seventh day, he rested. And he blessed the seventh day. And he made it holy. Not only did he sanctify it and bless it, make it holy, but he observed it. He rested on the day. And when we do that, we're reminded of God's creation. But we need to, you know, go, I guess, step by step, because many people would agree with that. They say, well, sure he did, but later on, it was changed, you know. I think the change, many people say, happened in the apostles after Christ's resurrection, that the disciples began to keep the first day, began to keep Sunday. But I'm getting a little ahead. We need to just go step by step. Exodus 20, verse 8, it talks about, of course, here in Exodus 20, God is reintroducing Israel to his law. They had been in captivity for 400 years in pagan Egypt. And they're being reintroduced to his laws. And of course, right smack in the middle of the laws, 20 verse 8, it says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Remember the Sabbath day. So it's already established, but remember the Sabbath day. And if you go back to Exodus 16, verse 21 through 23, before Moses even brought the laws down on the stones, of course, the Israelites were in the desert, in the wilderness, and they were being fed with manna. God would provide manna for them 6 days a week. They would gather the manna. On the seventh day, they couldn't. It was a day of rest. They didn't do that. So we see that up to that time, the Sabbaths and all God's laws were in effect. Then you go forward to Matthew 5. Christ is on earth. What did he do? Well, in Matthew 5, verse 18-19, he made the point that until heaven and earth pass away, not a jot or a tittle of the law would by any means pass away. And there, again, we know the Sabbath is part of that basic law. And also in Matthew 12, verse 8, it tells us that Jesus is Lord of the Sabbath. So, you know, Some might think, well, it doesn't matter that much if we keep Sunday or the first day or the seventh day or the fourth day, whatever, as long as we keep a day. But it doesn't seem to indicate that God doesn't care about this, what day we keep. And then we go forward still more to, Mark 1, chapter 1, verse 21, and Mark 6, verse 2, and Luke 4, 16. There's just three verses where Jesus taught on the Sabbath. He observed the Sabbath. He taught on the Sabbath. And let's turn to Luke 4, 16 and read that one. I think it's kind of important. They all are. Luke 4, 16. Today I'm reading out of the King James, New King James Version, because it probably follows along with what most people are reading better. And here it's early in his ministry, verse 16. So he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up to read. Of course, we see that was his custom to keep the Sabbath. And he taught on the Sabbath. He healed on the Sabbath. But again, we need to go forward to after his resurrection, his death and resurrection, and see what was going on at that point. And in Acts 13, we'll pick it up there. Acts 13 and verse 13. And of course, here's Paul, and I think it's Barnabas with him. And now Paul and his party set sail from Paphos, and they came to Perga and Pamphylia, and John, departing from them, returned to Jerusalem. But when they departed from Perga, they entered Antioch in Pisidia and went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and sat down. So here we see Paul in the synagogue on the Sabbath. And of course, the leader of the synagogue asked if he had anything to say. And boy, did he. He had a lot to say. Teaching about Jesus, and he was the way to salvation. And he went on to reiterate that. And we'll go down to verse 42. And I guess a lot of the Jews weren't too happy to hear the message that he had, but verse 42 says, "So when the Jews went out of the synagogue," I guess after service were over, they went out, "the Gentiles that were there begged that these words might be preached to them the next Sabbath." And here would have been a great teaching moment for Paul if he was wanting to emphasize the first day of the week. He could have said, well, why wait till the Sabbath? You know, we don't need to wait till the Sabbath. Tomorrow's the Lord's day. We'll meet and we'll teach then. But we go down to verse 44 and read that on the next Sabbath, almost the whole city came together to hear the word of God. So we see that Paul is still keeping and teaching on the Sabbath. And, of course, Acts 14 and 1, we don't need to read that, I don't guess, but at Iconium, Paul and Barnabas spoke in the synagogue on the Sabbath. And Acts 17, we'll go to that one, Acts 17, verse 2. Well, I'll start in verse 1. Now when they had passed through Amphipolis and came to Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. Verse 2. Then Paul, as his custom was, went into them and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures. So, anyway, evidence says that they were keeping the Sabbath. It hadn't been changed. And, you know, if the apostles had taken it on themselves to change the Sabbath, what would have been their authority to do so? I mean, you're talking about a basic commandment of God. And I'm thinking there would have been quite an uproar if one or two of the apostles said, well, by the way, you think Sunday is a proper day? And we see no such argument in the Acts or anywhere else I'm aware of. But let's take a look at what's going to happen in the future. And I always like to do that. So in closing, we'll go to Isaiah 66. Get there eventually. Isaiah 66, verse 22. This whole chapter is talking, Isaiah 66 is talking about Zion's future hope. You know, Zion is a word that encompasses more than one thing. You know, it originally just indicated a hill there, one of the hills that Jerusalem was built on. Then it represented Jerusalem. Nowadays, it represents anything Jewish, their law or their religion or whatever. So Zion is a word. But anyway, this chapter is Zion's future hope. And of course, it is the future, and God's talking about His kingdom. Verse 22, "For as the new heavens and the new earth, which I will make, shall remain before me, says the Lord, so shall your descendants and your name remain. And it shall come to pass that from one new moon to another, and from one Sabbath to another, all flesh, not Jews, not just Israel, but all flesh shall come to worship before me, says the Lord." To me, that seems conclusive.
The title of this message is "How Not to Be Deceived or Devoured by the Apostasy." If you were to ask someone, what's the first sign that Jesus Christ gave of the end time? It's kind of surprising. The first sign He gave was deception, being deceived. So I'm going to look at Matthew 24. I know we all know it, but it's just interesting to see the first thing that Christ warned about, Matthew 24, verse 4. Because they were admiring the temple, and He said what was going to happen. And then they said, well, what are the signs? The first thing He said was, verse 4, "Jesus answered them and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you. Take heed that no one deceives you." And if you look at the four horsemen of the apocalypse, in Revelation 6, the first one rides a white horse, means deception. He conquers people with deception by deceiving them. And because it's on a white horse, deception looks pure and good. So that the people who are deceived, it's like the devil doesn't actually have a pitchfork. He's red and two horns. Actually, when you read the Bible, it says the devil is beautiful and bright and shiny. He was the light bringer. That's not his title now, Lucifer. But in other words, deception looks good. That's the point I'm getting at. The opposite of what you think. And actually, most con men are good-looking people. We always think of villains as ugly and grisly because that's how Hollywood portrays them. But I'm sure there are some ugly villains too. But the world is not quite that simple. It really isn't. So how do we become deception-proof? How do we become deception-proof? Christ said not to be troubled by the early signs like deception and earthquakes. This is just the beginning of the end time period. We're at the beginning of the end time period. But during this beginning, get ready and be prepared so that we cannot be deceived. And that's kind of what we're going to talk about this afternoon, getting ready. I believe that not being deceived is a long-term process. It's not like you just read one little article, now I don't have to worry about ever being deceived. A lot of things in life are not that simple. I mean, it's not wrong to read one good article, but you can't protect yourself just like that. We need to have a deep understanding of certain issues, and it takes time to develop a deep understanding of certain things. It's not instantaneous. And we live in a postmodern age.
And what I mean by a postmodern age is the elites, the people who lead this society, they don't believe there's a real God. Now, they probably wouldn't, most of them wouldn't say, if you survey, do you believe in God? Well, sort of a God. And a God of their imagination, a God as they want God to be, not as he really is revealed. But they don't believe in a real God that you have to take seriously. They end up, truth is all relative. So they end up, they create a God as they want him to be, allowing them to do whatever they want to do. Many of the great philosophers who pushed things like evolution and humanism, they admitted they had certain bad habits and trends and things they wanted to do, and they didn't want, the God of the Bible getting in the way. But generally speaking, this relative view of God, or God making God whatever you want him to be, precedes the moral decline of a society. They argue that, the things in the Bible, they're just stories. There really wasn't Jonah, and the Israelites really didn't cross the Red Sea. And we were here at a program this morning with some scientists. We said, no, that didn't really happen. And the guy brought out the evidence. Apparently, there's a lot of real paleontological evidence about the Israelites in Egypt and all that. And, of course, I'd say the Bible is a much more reliable history book than the ones they want to rely on. But they didn't want to believe it because that's the kind of God they want. And if God is dead, then what dies with him? There is no truth. There is no absolute foundation of what's right and wrong. It's whatever we want it to be. And maybe 40 years from now, we'll want it to be something different. That's how the world views it. Whatever we want it to be. This happened to Israel as they got infected with the paganism and worldly attitudes of the nations around them before they went into captivity. Let's go to Isaiah 59 and just look at it again, the attitudes that were in Israel before they went into captivity. And ask yourself, is this starting to be more and more that way in America? I know America's been moving away from God. Actually, certain Supreme Court decisions and things they've been doing in higher education for many years, but it's getting stronger. They're pushing us to accept things that 20 or 30 years ago, nobody would have even thought about. Isaiah 59, verse 1. Behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened, that he cannot save, nor his ear heavy, that he cannot hear. But your iniquities, and that means breaking God's laws, have separated you from your God, and your sins have hidden his face from you, so that he will not hear. Because God is too holy to really bless and put up with a lot of rampant evil. For your hands are defiled with blood, and your fingers with iniquity. You have spoken lies. I want to emphasize that. You've spoken lies and muttered perversity. Does it seem like much of the media, academia, education, Hollywood is pushing perversity? And many, many politicians and almost an entire political party, with a few exceptions, is pushing perverseness. So, and I'm giving you my opinion, as you can tell me later if you disagree. Why is the mainstream trying to destroy Ben Carson? Now, some of you may know the story, and I don't know how this will end. It'll probably hurt him in the polls, but my wife says he'll recover. I was also in ROTC during the 60s, like he was, but I was in the college version. He was in the high school version. But I understand some of the mysticism it had. And I always give you my little experience because it's something I remember. The first day I went, by the way, in our universities, you had to be in ROTC the first 2 years. People were a lot more patriotic back in the 60s than they are now, especially in colleges. Things have really changed a lot. So you had to be in. So I went in and I said, well, I want to volunteer to be guide on bear. So I volunteered. They gave me an extra stripe. I mean, that's a big deal at the time. And my grandmother said, I saw you on television. We marched down one of these main streets in the city, and they actually put it on television. I didn't know that, but, yeah, I got to be on television. I'm saying this to let you know, ROTC was a big deal in the 60s. Well, in the 60s, Ben Carson was the top ROTC cadet. There's a special title, and I forgot to write the title down, for the entire city of Detroit. And back then, by the way, the city of Detroit was a more vibrant, prosperous place than it is now. Because you look at Detroit now, it's Disasterville from 40 years of welfare state and other bad policies. But it was a pretty vibrant city then. So you got to put yourself back in the 60s so this makes sense. And so he was told by the sergeant major that ran the program at his high school that he was going to meet General Westmoreland and some other. He was the hero of the Vietnam War at the time, and they probably thought they'd win the war. But you know, the media undercut them on the home front. Another story. But I'll try to put you in Ben Carson's mind at the time. So and maybe he got a few of the details about, supposedly, say, the newspapers of the dates and all mixed up, a few details. But he was at some banquet, and he talked to the generals and all the other bigwigs. And they told him he was a shoo-in to go to West Point if he wanted to. So he took that to mean I had an opportunity to go to West Point. And knowing the grades and the test scores that he had, and he was a top ROTC cadet, I can't believe that he would not. And these generals were telling him, because I knew how they think, they were saying, you're the kind of young man that we want in the Army, leadership. So I imagine he was probably a shoo-in. They told him that. But he actually did not apply. He didn't follow through on that. He chose, he said he wanted to be in medicine instead, which is a little more risky because no one can guarantee you're going to get a medical school. And the ROTC West Point was probably a sure thing, but he chose not to take it. Well, the media picked that story up and his life story. He actually didn't say, I applied, but they went to West Point, no application. He lied. He lied. He didn't. Well, it's maybe he didn't give all the details in his life story. But here's the point I'm asking. Whether he should have put more details in about all that or not, and, you know, his assuming that if the Westmoreland and these other bigwigs told him he was a shoo-in, you know, maybe he shouldn't have taken that to be the sure thing, but I can see why he would do it. And I'm sure he would have got in. But the point is, why is the media focusing on a little story, was that 50-some years ago, whatever it is exactly, to that extent? I'm giving you my opinion, because they want to destroy him and his candidacy. And here's how I think the media thinks. Anyone who's going to destroy, who's going to slow down, or maybe even possibly halt America's revert toboggan slide into decadence and the progressive agenda, they want to block them. Anybody. Now, I'm not saying that he and which candidate would be the best. I know that's quite a debate, and no one really knows. You don't really know what a person will do in a tight spot until he gets there, you know, who's going to be the hero, isn't. But the media does not want Ben Carson because he belongs to the way they see it, a very conservative, Bible-oriented church. That's the last thing they want. Same with Romney. Even though Romney was a nice guy, you know, they didn't want a guy like that. And they are going to do every. I think in Romney's case, he bullied some kid in the 10th grade, and they made a big issue of that. Some of you might remember that. But this was supposed to be the knockout punch. Somebody called me and told, they've knocked Ben Carson out. And I listened to it. Was it ABC Radio News? Ben Carson's been caught in a lie. Oh, his candidacy is destroyed. It was on the radio. I mean, the regular radio. A story like of that minor nature should not have gotten the lead on the radio. They want to get him. Now, here's how I think they think. They fear, I mean, when I say they, I mean the leadership that's moving America down the toboggan slide, they fear the biblical viewpoint. They fear the biblical moral viewpoint. They also fear any black American who's getting off the progressive liberal plantation. Yeah, I've got a little of that criticism myself. But God's protected me. But the point I'm getting is they know what they don't want. And that's why it was so important to get him. And if this doesn't knock him out, they'll keep searching for people that don't like him or something until they do knock him out. So I'm telling you to brace yourself for a lot of negative stuff coming down the pipe. I think he's probably the one they want to get first. And then it's probably Ted Cruz. I'm giving you my opinion. You might disagree with that. Then, you know, and maybe they might accept a few, I won't mention names, that they might accept who might possibly win. But once they get the nomination, they'll be against them too, of course. They're going to support the most progressive, liberal, anti-Bible candidate they can get. And here's why they also fear it. This last election shows some things they need to worry about. Now, I'm going to read verse 10. And this is roughly around 700 B.C., just a few years, according to the Bible commentaries I have at home, before Israel went into captivity. And here's what God's prophet told them. Verse 10. That he's talking about the Israelites. We grope for the wall like the blind. We grope as if we had no eyes. We stumble at noonday as at twilight. We're as dead men in desolate places. In other words, they lost all of their wisdom. All of their spiritual insight was gone. And I look at some of the foolishness of our current government and the media, and maybe it's not quite that bad, but it's like they're losing common sense. Of course, I'm being opinionated. You can disagree. Like, there's a high school in the Chicago suburbs. The federal government's going to cut them off. They've wormed themselves into so many programs that it would really be a disaster for that high school if they don't let this boy who, you know, thinks he's a girl or wants to be a girl, whatever the exact term is, and they're trying to be nice, and I don't hate the kid. I don't know anybody think this is against him. They're saying he's got to be able to shower with the girls with no restrictions, no special little shower curtain for him. He's got to be able to shower with the girls. And the school system says, but the girls don't want it. Isn't that common sense? But they can't see it. They're spiritually blind. Or common sense handicapped, if you want to use that term. But not everybody's going that way. The Houston results, which is the same kind of thing, that anybody can use any bathroom. I mean, any man, when he feels he's a woman, can go to the women's bathroom. You imagine how that's going to go down. I don't think men are too worried about women coming to their bathroom, but I don't know if that's what everybody wants. But that's why the media is worried, because several little small things about marijuana and others show the American public is not going as fast as they want. There's some resistance to the push down the toboggan slide. Ohio rejected marijuana. Maybe it's complicated in Ohio. There were some other reasons why. Kentucky shocked everybody. I hope I get this right. They elected a Tea Party governor and the first African-American who's a Tea Party supporter, for the first African-American to get a statewide office in Kentucky. Tea Party, lieutenant governor. That's a bit of a shock to the media. What in the world's going on? And most of the advertising money was against them. That's even more shocking. So in other words, it wasn't just a fluke. It was the people are starting to resist this a little bit. Or some in some places. Maybe not New York and L.A. Although in San Francisco, the sheriff who came out, supported the sanctuary city, and he was within his rights to let that killer go, even though the feds said he should be retained and deported. And then, of course, he killed the girl on Fisherman's Wharf. Even San Francisco voted that sheriff out. I mean, that maybe is the biggest shock. That's San Francisco. The people are starting to show some resistance. That's why the media is worried. Verse 14, Isaiah 59. Justice is turned back. Righteousness stands afar off. Truth is fallen in the streets. When I listen to some of the stuff that they teach and some of the stuff that's in the media, I feel like saying, truth is fallen in the streets. Can you believe maybe over half of what the media tells you? You wonder, well, what's the context? What didn't they show you? What didn't they say? Truth is fallen in the streets. I would distrust academia, court decisions. Remember, this is still the devil's age, and he's still the biggest number one influencer in our society, and he's pushing hard to pull things in his direction. Let's go to 2 Thessalonians. Now, as backdrop to this scripture, most of us know it well. It shows the man of the beast going to the temple in Jerusalem. I know you're saying, but there is no temple in Jerusalem. That's one of the things they're fighting over with the Arabs about now. But by the way, when Daniel prophesied the abomination of desolation, the original version that Christ talked about, there was no temple then either. It's coming. the fact that some Jews may have prayed up there got certain Islamic people all upset. But he goes to that temple. Now I want to pick it up in verse 6, Thessalonians 2, 6. And now you know what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time. Actually, we don't know. It's possible that Paul, in some sermon in the past, told the Thessalonians how God was holding back the devil's last plot to push, you know, Babylon the Great and all the evil that's going to come right near the end. But we actually don't know. All we know from what we hear in verse 6 is God has like a little brick holding the devil's final plan from going into fruition. But as you watch the world move ahead, how close are we to God kicking that brick out and letting the devil's final scheme roll downhill on the world to great deception? I think we're getting closer to that point. And we'll recognize it when we see it. One thing that always amazes me, you look at ISIS. They're doing terrible things. I mean, groups of things. I don't want to mention some of it in the public. I mean, doing terrible things to people. Throwing, 15 boys off a roof because they watched a soccer game. I mean, but all kinds of things that I won't even mention. And they brag about it. They put it on the internet and all over. At least the Nazis hid their atrocities. I'm thinking, what in the world are we getting to? It's a level of barbarism that, well, at least we haven't seen it in our lifetime. And someone is going to come out of that King of the South. And it's probably going to be them, but maybe that's for future debate who it's going to be. But God is restraining the devil's full-time, end-time prophecy deception. He's holding it back, but it's coming. He's restraining it. But it'll come full speed ahead, leading the world to a moral and military abyss. It's coming very soon. Now, if I was a con man, you know, a con man cannot con an honest person. You have to be greedy, stingy, thief, or something like that to be con, right? The same is true of deception. To be deceived, you have to not love the truth. And the truth doesn't matter. It's whatever you want to get out of it. And that's kind of the point that I think Paul makes. We'll pick it up in verse 8. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 8. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan. So Satan is doing all this behind the great deception. Work of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders. Now, here's why Satan is able to pull this off. He's doing it little by little, getting us ready for it. With all unrighteousness, deception among those who perish because they do not receive the love of the truth. Why are they easy targets? They do not love the truth. And I would add, they do not really believe in a real God and a real Bible and really love God as well. Maybe they have a religion, but it's a convenience kind of thing. And they put spin on the truth, or we might call it spin or twist. And that's actually a political term now. You hire political consultants who spin the truth, whatever it is, to make the politician look good. And they pay these guys big money to spin the truth. And the world revolves around lies, half-truths, and twisted truth. Verse 11 and 12. And for this reason, God will send them strong delusion. Strong delusion. That they should believe the lie. And they will actually worship this man sitting on some probably great ivory throne right there in the temple of God, probably in one of those holy places, with cameras on him all over the internet and satellite TV, and they will worship the man. Whether they believe he's God or not, it probably doesn't matter. They don't really care about God and the truth. They're going to do what's the right thing to do, worship the man. For this reason, God will send them strong delusions that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who do not believe the truth, but have pleasure in unrighteousness. They enjoy evil. Now, let me give you a propaganda technique that will be used by the beast and has been used in the past. It's called deification. Deification. And deification means you take this leader and you turn him into a god. You deify him. You use the propaganda and the education mechanism of that nation to deify him. I was going to mention two men that were deified. One was Stalin, the other was Mao Zedong. And they, of course, were deified, the mechanism. And actually, they got videos and books all about how they deified Stalin and Mao. We know more about Russia because China is a little bit of a mystery, but there's still a fair amount of information about China as well. In total socialism, there is no God. So you don't have any other God. So they put these men who are mass murderers. Stalin killed of his own people, not talking about combat and war. He killed 3 times more people than Hitler did. Of course, Russia has more people than Germany, but still, he killed 20 million Russians in horrible gulags. And well, I don't want to mention, but just read about it. You'll be shocked at the stuff that went on in the Soviet Union. At the same time, he was being worshipped as a god. And he can use that godlike status to manipulate and deceive people. Because if Stalin said it, by the way, Stalin means the man of steel or something like that in Russia. By the way, Hitler's name was Schicklgruber. He changed it to Hitler because it has somewhat of a similar meaning in German. They even changed their name to make it more godlike, at least in some cases. But there is no God, so who else are they going to look to? These men were pure evil. There's some on the American History Channel, and they've got some really good stories in case you want to just see about Mao and Hitler and Stalin. It'll be a little bit tough to watch because there's this one scene. I'll just describe it to you. And I've also got several books with more details on Mao. At one point, I'll give you two stories about Mao because most people don't know these. It's not known by most Americans. They know a lot about Stalin stuff. At one point, when he was at his camp in Western China and they were solidifying their army and their power, he said, "We need to have more open thinking." He wanted to smoke out if there's anybody who dared disagree with him on anything. And one leader came to the top, a charismatic guy. He had some different ideas and some improvements and. So at some point, in the middle of the night, he had that guy arrested, and he had him tortured, and he had a particular torture technique that he loved. You break the guy's knee the opposite way the knee is supposed to, and he sat and enjoyed it. And then another story about Mao that's interesting. At one of those big Communist Party meetings, he wanted to do some more of that stupid stuff that they were doing, that leaving millions of Chinese starving. And the second in command, an older man, he was still a good Communist Party supporter. He says, "Let's admit it, Mao, these things are not working. We can't keep doing this. It's not working. People are starving." He was so popular with the party, Mao couldn't do anything about it at the time, so he had to go along with the guy's thing. But Mao seethed inside. "I am the great God, Mao Zedong, and somebody dares disagree with me." So he started something a few years later called the Red Guard. And all the young people had these little red books of Mao. And he said, "There are people who are standing in the way of our pure revolution." And he unleashed them on the older generation. And the young kids were able to beat up, many of them beat to death their teachers and older administrators, grandparents. It's really gruesome stuff. You can read about it. I'm not making any of this stuff up. And eventually, but that was, they think, his whole point. He got that older guy, who was second in command, put in that category, and a bunch of young people roughed him up, and then they threw him in a They call them re-education camps, but they really were gulags. And Mao enjoyed seeing him tortured. And this is evil. But they used, and all those young people were, Mao is God. We read books and ran around. And they used that to manipulate the public. Now, obviously that's pure evil. And you can read about others, Pol Pot in Cambodia. And these guys love to see their rivals tortured. Even Hitler loved to see those generals hanging on hooks. He tried to kill him because he screwed Germany up. And he had to make a video of that so he could watch them being tortured and killed for his entertainment. I want to give you some idea how evil these men who were worshipped as gods were. Well, there is a... I believe this is coming. We're going to see someone coming who may be even worse. One last time, the final empire, the beast. We're going to see two kings, one in the Middle East and one in Europe. One will be the rebirth of the Holy Roman Empire, and this guy will be even worse. Based on the way the scriptures say it, nothing like the world has ever seen before. That means it's got to be worse than Stalin. You think, wow, could that possibly be true? That's why you want to stay with the church and be the place of safety. Or if you're a great martyr, then, you know, it's to your credit. But, you know, you read books like 1984, where the great dictator suddenly says right is wrong and wrong is right, and the public just automatically, like drones, obey it. And then he changes his mind a few years later, and the public just automatically obeys it. When you read the book, you think, nobody could ever manipulate people that easily. I don't know. You see what's happened in Russia and China and Germany? You just never know. I'm just saying, we're going to live to see, I believe, where truth is, whatever the great dictator says that truth is. But there's a lesser amount of this that happened in God's church. Let's go to 1 Corinthians. And it is a little bit of a threat to us, at least for some people. I want to just cover this. 1 Corinthians 3. Now, the audience I'm speaking to, you're familiar with this, but for the sake of those who see it on the tape, I want to just mention it again. 1 Corinthians 3, 3 through 4. Paul writes to the Corinthians, verse 3, 1 Corinthians 3. For you are still carnal, for where there are envy, strife, divisions among you. That's the word we want to emphasize. Divisions among you. Are you not carnal, behaving like mere men? For when one says, I'm of Paul, another, I'm of Apollos. Are you not carnal? I believe certain leaders within the Corinthian church were using certain men like Peter and Paul and Apollos as icons to divide the church. And they would put Peter, let's say, on a pedestal, which is easy to see how that could be done. And they said, I, whoever that man was in Corinth, I am the only one who really, truly follows him. I am his successor. I'm the Peter guy in this part of the world. And that means I get to crowd up on that pedestal with him. Therefore, follow me. Verse 5. Who then is Paul? Who is Apollos? But ministers. Remember the word ministers means servant. When you get to be a minister in this church, you're going to serve a lot. Anyway, it means servants through whom you believe as the Lord gave to each one. And basically, when Paul says, who then is Paul? He's even saying, I don't even deserve to be on a pedestal. That's what he's saying. Who's Paul? And you read the whole rest of the chapter, he clearly makes that clear. He doesn't even judge himself. But people put certain apostles on a pedestal, so the man who did it can kind of get up there on the pedestal with him and manipulate people. Paul, in the second book of Corinthians, calls those men false apostles. He never names them. We don't know if they repented and whatever happened. But there were false leaders in Corinth who used ministers on a pedestal to manipulate people. Let's go to verse 21, 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 22. And Paul just adds a little more to it. He says, verse 21, therefore, let no one boast in men, for all things are yours. In other words, don't boast about the great leader Paul, the great leader Peter, the great leader Apollos. And therefore, you know, however that boasting can be used to manipulate people. And one thing you can say about the Bible, almost all the Bible heroes, at least if they get enough coverage in the Bible, some don't, aren't barely mentioned, you know their weaknesses as well as their strengths, right? There are probably some bad things we don't know about, I don't even guess, but Paul admits, you know, in Romans 7 that there were times he didn't do what he wanted to do. He was not as spiritual as he wanted to be. And you know, he had that terrible split with Barnabas, which is not a good thing for either one of them. So Paul is not perfect either. Verse 22, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or things present or things to come, all are yours. In other words, all these leaders are there to serve you. Don't put them on a pedestal. Don't let men glory in men. And I know that we live in a world where they glory in men. And you get some big celebrity, like, I just heard this this morning. It's in good news in a way. A certain great basketball star in Ohio supported the marijuana thing. It didn't matter. The voter still said no. And he was really a very popular guy. I'm tempted to mention his name, but I won't for the, because this tape may be around for years. I don't want to, you know, disparage the guy, I'm sure. But, you know, and movie stars and fashion stars and other TV stars, they're just people. Don't put them on a pedestal. Believe everything they say. A lot of these movie stars, they don't know anything about anything. They just happen to have good hair and a cute face. That's all they got. There are no brains in there. They're reading lines. Well, some of them may be a little smarter than others, but you know, don't get too carried away. This movie star is so charming, and or news anchor, as Rush Limbaugh calls them, info babes. That doesn't mean that everything they say is right and has to be believed. Some people put HWA on a pedestal, and then they say, it's his successor. I'm kind of up there, too. And they manipulate people in a cultish way. And that's wrong. Now, I want to tell you this corny story. So I'm trying to make my point here. It's a corny story called weightlifting. A father was doubtful about his son's resolve. He said, do you really want to buy all these weights? The son's, yes, I want to be like Arnold Schwarzenegger. I like to imitate his voice, but I can't do it right. I want all these muscles. I want all these weights. He said, but are you going to use them? Really use them? Oh, yes, Dad. I'm going to stick to it. I'm going to use them. He said, but you know how you get tired of stuff? This costs a lot of money. No, Dad, I want to be with it. I'm really into this weightlifting stuff. So the dad relents and says, okay, Danny, you get it. I'll buy the equipment. And as they're leaving the store, the son yells, what? You mean I have to help carry these heavy items to the car? See how committed he is to the face already. It sounds like he is. And a lot of these leaders probably claim to be really strong, like that weightlifting boy wanted to be. But many of them were false apostles. And there are a lot of false people out there on TV and on the internet, so beware. So what's the cure so that you can't be deceived? You know, Jeremiah 9, 23 and 24 that we read last weekend says, the most valuable thing is to know God. It's more valuable than strength, power, and money, knowing God. So we should focus on knowing God and have put pure thoughts, positive thoughts, like Philippians 4:8, where Paul says, focus on the good and the positive. And to avoid deception, here are just a few recommendations we're going to look at here as we close this message. I'll call this A. The best thing you can do is have a close relationship with Jesus Christ and God and be responsible for your own spiritual destiny. Let's go back to Matthew 24. Being responsible means, just as Carl Hill said, you have to know it yourself. And know why you believe it yourself. I think he did a nice way of saying that. And know it for yourself as well. I mean, you'll benefit from sermons and Bible study, but also know it yourself so that you could defend if you have to. That's the highest level of knowing something. You can defend it. Matthew 24, verse 11. Then many false prophets shall rise up, deceiving many. And here's why, verse 12. Because lawlessness, that means they don't want to bother with God's laws and maybe some of the other laws as well. Lawlessness will abound and the love of many will grow cold. And I believe it's both love of God and love of fellow man. It grows cold. Once you don't love God, you don't love the truth, you don't really want to obey anything, aren't you ripe for deception? And aren't you ripe for deception? You don't love God, you don't love the truth, and you don't want to obey any laws that are inconvenient to you, you're ripe for deception. B, realize Satan is the prince of this world. He's the prince of this world. And expect lies in the media and education. Go to Romans 12, 1 and 2. And there are other verses we could turn to, but Satan is the prince of this world until Christ gets back in not too distant future. Romans 12, 1 and 2. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world. Let me read that part again. Do not be conformed to this world. So what is popular in the world? Some of it's not necessarily what you want to believe. But be transformed by the renewing of your mind. By the renewing of our mind. That you may prove what is the good, acceptable, and perfect will of God. Prove it to yourself. Prove it to yourself. Like that famous song goes, this is not our world. C, learn all about God's message to us, the Bible. Paul compliments the Bereans because they checked with Scripture as he preached. And they found what he said, of course, was true. Unlike all the other towns that he had gone into in the past, they proved it to themselves. And sure, sermons and Bible studies can help, but we need to also know it inside, internally, each other. D, never ever blindly accept what contradicts any part of the Word of God, Old Testament or New Testament. If you're reading something and they say, well, God was wrong about this, that, and the other thing. Or now, let me admit, there are probably a few things in the Old Testament, maybe a few decisions we don't fully understand. But I would never, ever, ever say God was wrong. I would say that we don't understand it. Remember, a lot of these things were done 35 centuries ago, when the world was so different as far as slavery, its treatment of women, how countries warred with each other, and you know, maybe the choice was kill them or make them prisoners of war. It's such a different world. So some of the things you're going to read about by today's standards, you say, well, why didn't they do something different? Well, all I'm saying is, nothing God did was wrong. We may not understand it, but anybody who goes to parts of the Bible and says, oh, well, that's God, wrong, don't listen to them. You may be being led astray. Or they're led astray, too. E, always be open in our hearts to God, because revelation is really a spiritual matter. Really understand the Bible is a spiritual matter. You have to open your heart and ask God to put